On the cover of Diana Preston's latest book is the image of Eve holding an atom. Like that bite into the apple in the Garden of Eden, the advent of nuclear weapons has been at the cost of another kind of innocence. But the road to their development began as a more noble pursuit to learn the nature of nature itself. In her new book, Before the Fallout, From Marie Curie to Hiroshima, Ms. Preston traces the study of nuclear physics from its beginnings in the X-ray to its military apotheosis in the bomb. It's published by Walker & Company. I'm very pleased it has brought Diana Preston back to my show today. Hello.
Hello there.
This is a kind of a biography of the early days of nuclear weapons and the research that went into them. When did they first become conceivable?
Well, people first started to realize that there was more to the physical world around them than what you could see with the naked eye way back in the 1890s. And I found this quite strange when I began the research for this, that when I looked at the 1890s, this was really a pivotal time. People really thought there was no more great discoveries to be made. And yet, in 1895, we have a German scientist stumbling on X-rays. We have a French scientist discovering that there's some sort of penetrating energy coming from within the atom. And it was those discoveries that really triggered Marie Curie to start with her experiments and really opened the whole field up.
Well, how much did she know about the atom? And how did we get from what she knew to the creation of nuclear weapons?
Well, what Marie Curie did was that she followed up this work that other scientists had been doing, and she took it to the level where she was able to identify, for the first time, radioactive elements. She was the discoverer, of course, of radium. You know, picture this little Polish lady standing in the courtyard of her laboratory in Paris, stirring vats of bubbling chemicals with a stick almost as big as she was, you know, reducing this down to produce these real sources of glowing material. She described her excitement at going into her laboratory and seeing these sources glowing bluely. And she was the person who said, well, there seems to be some sort of energy within the atom. What I'm observing appears to be an atomic property. And this really was the signpost that there was something going on within the atom, but that it's a huge step from that, of course, to the later development of atomic weapons.
Well, did anyone at that time recognize that there were certain dangers in radiation?
They didn't recognize those dangers at that stage. It really seemed like a kind of scientific playground for the physicists of the time. It triggered a whole series of discoveries to look inside the atom. You had Ernest Rutherford deducing around 1911 that actually, you know, the atom consists of a whole load of nothing with fuzzy boundaries, but at its center, a tiny positively charged nucleus. Of course, this would be key to nuclear weapons. But at that time, people were still trying to discover what the atom consisted of, identifying the different subatomic particles. It's not really till you get into the 1930s that you find the debate opening out as to whether this is really the beginning of some sort of new energy, which could be used for benign or hostile purposes, or whether it was still just an interesting piece of science.
And was it necessary for quantum physics to have been developed to get to that point?
It helped. You had, you know, quantum theory first being developed by the German physicist Max Planck around 1900, explaining the way in which energy behaved. And this work was taken further forward in Germany in the 1920s. You have Werner Heisenberg building on quantum theory for his famous quantum mechanics. But if you like, that was a theoretical mathematical interpretation of results that the experimentalists were coming up with. It helped to explain what was going on and to perhaps to trigger further lines of thought, if not at that stage being absolutely critical to the development of what would become nuclear weapons.
And how early did they discover that different elements had different properties? Some had more electrons than others.
Those discoveries were made very early on. Really, you have Ernest Rutherford, the New Zealander, you know, the so-called father of experimental physics, doing a lot of work on how elements behaved and how one element would transmute into another kind of element. You had the work done by Marie Curie, which was interpreted for her by other scientists who said, you have identified elements which have never before been seen. So all through that period, you know, the early 1900s into the 20s, you have people investigating the elements, finding out about isotopes, starting to fill in the gaps in the elemental table, starting to understand much more about individual elements, even if they didn't yet have their finger on the pulse that, you know, these studies were going to lead to something very fundamental for all of us.
Wasn't it the discovery of one thing in particular, the neutron, that was a major step towards not only a more complete understanding of the atom, but also toward understanding that we could create nuclear weaponry.
Absolutely. What happened in 1932 was that you had an English scientist called James Chadwick working at the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge University in England, and he made the discovery that at the heart of the atom in the nucleus was this atomic particle, the neutron. The important thing about the neutron was it was quite large, it had quite a lot of mass, but it had no electrical charge. So it was the ideal missile with which to bombard other atoms, because this would go right into the heart of the nucleus of an atom and enable you to start tinkering around. And as you say, it was that discovery which would be key to the development of a bomb, because neutron bombardment was how you actually manufactured your atomic bomb fuel.
What was it about that Cavendish laboratory? Later, Watson and Crick worked out of it, didn't they?
That's right, later on. I mean, the Cavendish Laboratory at this time did a lot of the critical work in this area, but you know, I want you to picture something operating on a very small scale. They used what they call their string and sealing wax principles. They had very little funding, really, and the philosophy of the laboratory was that you used whatever you could find for your experiments. You didn't need expensive kit. They even used plasticine to create vacuums on their experimental equipment.
Anybody who goes by it on a visit to Cambridge will be stunned by how much important science came out of such an uninteresting-looking building.
That's right. As you say, it's not an exciting structure, but it was intellectually incredibly exciting for the scientists at the time because it was an intellectual hub. This was an international brotherhood of scientists, and many of them came to Cambridge to work with Rutherford. You had Germans, Americans, even Japanese scientists at that time, all flocking there to exchange their ideas.
And I get the sense from the book that everyone in physics knew everyone else at this time, from the turn of the century into, I guess, the 30s. There was a feeling that ideas should always be exchanged freely, even if they came from countries whose politics might have scared some people?
That's right. You know, until politics start to intervene in the 1930s, you're really talking about an international brotherhood. These people are friends. They've studied with each other at their different laboratories. They've gone on holiday. They've skied together. They've made music together. They've shared their results internationally. What mattered were not issues of race or nationality, but perhaps where you'd studied and with whom.
And Ernest Rutherford trained a dozen Nobel laureates, so he must have been a great person to study with.
That's right. I mean, that's why they called him the father of experimental physics, is this larger-than-life New Zealander with a great booming voice. What he'd say when he conducted his experiments was, "I feel it in my water." He was absolutely intuitive, had an extraordinary mind.
So was it not until the discovery of the neutron that people started thinking of the atom as something that could be used in weaponry?
That's right. I mean, the discovery of the neutron really was the big push forward, because the neutron is essential to achieving a nuclear chain reaction. And in the early 1930s, though, you find scientists' views diverging. You know, the great Rutherford, who died shortly afterwards, he announced in 1933 at a conference in London that anybody who thinks of liberating energy from the atom, you know, they're crazy. They're talking moonshine. That was his word, moonshine. But at the same time, you know, from 1934 onwards, you have others who are not quite so sure. In particular, the Hungarian physicist, the somewhat eccentric but very prescient Leo Szilard, who did predict that a chain reaction was possible. In fact, he thought it was so possible that he actually patented the idea and sent that patent off to the British Admiralty in London to keep it under wraps. But this was before there was any experimental proof that you could actually achieve a nuclear chain reaction.
Did he receive any money as a result of that patent?
I don't think so. I mean, what he was concerned about, really, say one of these very prescient scientists, what the implications were for the planet, for mankind. That's what was driving him, not financial considerations.
So what actually happens? We liberate this neutron. It is sent crashing into other atoms. And then does that liberate other neutrons and keep a chain reaction going?
Exactly. What they found was that in the right circumstances, if you bombarded atoms of heavy elements, in particular uranium, with a neutron, the neutron would hit the atom that would release further neutrons that would go off in turn and hit other atoms. So you could achieve a chain reaction. And you know, the big question in people's minds was, okay, well, we have a chain reaction, but how much energy is that really going to liberate, and is it going to be enough to actually achieve an explosion?
And where does nuclear fission come into all of this?
Well, nuclear fission, that term was coined at a very interesting time, really on the eve of the Second World War. I want you to picture some critical experiments happening in Nazi Germany at the time. Two German chemists, Otto Hahn, Fritz Strassmann, conducting experiments. They can't quite understand the results. They send the data to an exiled Jewish physicist friend, Lisa Meitner, who is now in exile in Stockholm. She is the person who interprets that they've actually split the nucleus of the uranium atom. Her nephew is working with her. He takes these findings back to his laboratory. He talks to an American biologist friend, and he says to this friend, William Arnold, what do you call the process when cells divide? What do you call that in biology? And Arnold thinks for a moment, and he replies, fission.
So we wind up with nuclear fission.
Absolutely.
And uranium is important to a plutonium, which is developed through out of uranium, right? That's important because it has so many electrons?
That's right, because they're heavy elements that will fission easily. And if you're looking at uranium, there is a tiny proportion of natural uranium, an isotope of it, which will fission quite easily in the right circumstances. That's why the quest to develop a bomb would actually depend on whether you could actually isolate enough of that tiny proportion of that isotope within natural uranium.
And is that why the hydrogen bomb is so much more powerful? Because it is not a heavy element? Because the energy that would be created from splitting that atom would be much greater?
Yes, what happened with the hydrogen bomb, which came later on, this was Edward Teller's...
I know, after the scope of your book.
That's right, but there, what you're really doing there, just put very simply, is you're talking about fusing light elements rather than fissioning heavy elements, which is how the first atom bomb was made.
Okay, so they have figured this out. This is all theoretical, and most college science students understand this. There's a big leap from this to creating a bomb.
That's right. I mean, what I found so fascinating about some of this was the timing. You know, the very eve of the Second World War, scientists interpret that you can actually fission the atom. Some people get very scared about this, and they say to their colleagues, you know, we in Britain, we in America, we must not publish any more results on this. They start to foresee the implications. If you like, the shutters come down at that point. This international brotherhood dissolves. You know, friendships are sundered. Personal betrayals happen. But people are now starting to think this is a science which must be kept for their own country, that war is coming. And they're starting to look now at whether it's genuinely a practical possibility to make a bomb.
And now it's not just in the hands of scientists. Now political figures are getting involved.
Yeah, well, what happens is that it really takes the scientists, though, to act as the catalyst. You know, governments at this time have got their eye on other things. It's, you know, you get to 1939, it's the early stages of the war in Europe. Britain very preoccupied with how it's going to defend itself. You have the scientists, particularly two refugee scientists who've had to flee from Nazi Germany and Austria, going to the British government and saying, look, everybody so far in the scientific world has said that you would need tons of this special type of uranium to make a bomb. We've done the calculations. You don't need tons of the stuff. You only need a few pounds, perhaps. This gets the British government to take it seriously. This then triggers the British government to send a group of scientists over, if you like, to the United States, saying, hey, please accelerate your program. We've got to do this because the Nazis may already be on the path.
And then there's the famous Einstein letter.
That's right.
To Roosevelt. But in your book, you also write about the Nazis reviewing science journals for military applications. Were all governments doing that at the time?
Oh, yeah, everybody was looking to see what was in the literature. But you find that at a certain stage, you know, people stop publishing their results. There is this concern, don't put your best information into the hands of your enemies. But in a sense, you know, a vacuum of information also triggers curiosity. And you find in Russia that at a certain stage, the Russian physicists there notice there is no longer anything being published. And you find one scientist saying to Stalin, you know, I am suspicious of the dogs who do not bark in the night. We've got to get on with this technology as well. But you have a polarization happening this time. Different projects happening in different countries, some of whom not yet combatant, some of which will soon be in the war, and they're all starting to go down their own paths in ignorance of what is going on in each other's countries.
Did the Japanese have any program?
Yeah, they did. There are several very eminent Japanese physicists, including a man called Nishina, who had studied with Rutherford at Cavendish in the early days. And at various stages during the war, Nishina was given tasks by the Japanese army and the Japanese navy. He also had a device for smashing atoms called a cyclotron. You know, why did he have a cyclotron? Because as part of this great pre-war brotherhood of scientists, the American, the famous atom smasher, Ernest Lawrence, had actually given Nishina the blueprints. So there was work going on in Japan as well, but for various reasons, it never really got very far.
My guest is Diana Preston, the historian and author of A First-Rate Tragedy, The Boxer Rebellion, Lusitania, other books as well, and with her husband, Michael, a pirate of exquisite mind. Her latest is called Before the Fallout, From Marie Curie to Hiroshima. It is published by Walker, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC. Stay with us. We're back with Diana Preston, whose latest book is Before the Fallout, From Marie Curie to Hiroshima, published by Walker. And although, Diana, this book is about scientific matters, it is also about human beings, and you always stress those stories. We can't get into all the personal stories, but it was so much fun to read and to think about the personalities of these people.
So what I really wanted to do with the story was, yes, of course, I wanted to know the science, but I wanted to look at the personalities, the stories of the individuals who were part of these great developments. And there were so many dramas, there were so many betrayals, so many extraordinary, ambiguous things happening. You know, for example, you have the German chemist Fritz Strassmann, one of the people who actually is involved in those experiments where they first find fission. You know, what is he doing during the Second World War? He is working on the Nazi bomb project, but he's living in Berlin, and in his Berlin apartment, he is helping to hide a Jewish pianist, helping to conceal her from the Nazis, and this was a piece of bravery for which he was later commended at Yad Vashem. So all these ambiguous things going on, I wanted to try and sort of pick away at those stories to understand what was really happening.
There were many Jewish scientists involved, and they'd been kicked out of the academy. What was the Academic Assistance Council?
The Academic Assistance Council was something which was set up very soon after Hitler came to power. It was set up in Britain. Ernest Rutherford was involved in it. Albert Einstein became involved in it. And it was really an escape route, if you like, for German physicists and scientists being kicked out of their jobs in Nazi Germany, because many of them were, you know, they counted as government officials in Germany. The Aryan laws that Hitler very speedily passed after he came to power pushed them all out of a job. You know, they had to find somewhere to go with their families, and so many of them were able to come to Britain. Jobs were found for them in the various universities around the country. But Rutherford, you know, he launched a great appeal. He spoke at the Albert Hall in London, saying to the intellectual, the academic community of Britain, look, this is serious. We have to help. You know, this was an area where Rutherford was very prescient. He could look ahead and see what was going to happen.
And many came here and actually worked on the Manhattan Project.
That's right.
Niels Bohr also helped out numerous scientists. How did he facilitate the placement of deposed Jewish scientists?
Yeah, Niels Bohr, really an integral figure in all of this. You know, not only is the person who helps develop the model of the atom, but a very gifted scientist working in Copenhagen. He is half Jewish himself, but when Denmark got overrun, he elected to stay in Copenhagen and look after his institute and try and protect his staff. But up until the point where Denmark was occupied, he had operated his institute as a kind of labor exchange, if you like, for scientists who were desperate now to get out of Germany and Austria. I mean, scientists who knew not only their careers but their lives now depended on having an invitation from somewhere overseas. So Bohr, again, was one of those people who provided an escape route for people to get out of Nazi-occupied countries.
But not every scientist was wonderful. There were some great betrayals as well, weren't there?
That's right. I mean, if you look at some of the scientists who remained in Germany, some of them chose to remain. They were not Nazis. People like Werner Heisenberg, they would have called themselves German patriots. They said it was their duty to stay in Germany. But some of the German scientists were very keen Nazis. They were very keen to denounce their Jewish colleagues. We have the story of Lisa Meitner, originally from Vienna. She'd come to Berlin before the First World War to study. Absolutely key scientist in the story of the development of the atom. She just manages to escape from Berlin with literally hours to spare. The Gestapo are about to arrest her. How does she get out of Nazi Germany? Well, one of her scientist friends helps her. He gives her his mother's diamond ring, helps get her out of the country. Why does she have to flee so fast? Because another scientist has denounced her. his actual words were that the Jewess endangers our institute. She was betrayed by a fellow scientific colleague.
Wasn't Werner Heisenberg called a white Jew by Nazi ideologues?
Yes. It's always, you know, some people think that because Werner Heisenberg stayed in Germany during the war, or he must have been a Nazi sympathizer. He genuinely wasn't, and at a certain stage, because he espoused the physics of Einstein, all the things which the Nazis were trying to denigrate, because at one stage they called atomic physics, you know, Jewish physics, they tried to denigrate it. Werner Heisenberg said, you know, this is a ridiculous attitude, you're interfering, you're playing games with intellectual things here. So, as you say, he was hauled in by the Gestapo. He was given a very unpleasant interview in a cellar deep in the Prinz Albert Strasse street in Berlin, where, you know, the Gestapo had their headquarters. On the wall was a very unpleasant message saying, you know, relax and breathe deeply. Imagine how sinister that must have seemed when you're being quizzed by the Gestapo. But eventually he got out of there, and one of the reasons was that his mother knew Himmler's mother, and Himmler's mother got her son to intervene on his behalf. So there was a big question mark in the Nazis' minds over Heisenberg for a long time. But it also has to be said that Heisenberg elected to stay in Nazi Germany. He could have gone overseas, but he thought it was his duty to remain. Perhaps, you know, he was naive, but he was a German patriot. He foresaw disaster. He wanted to be there after the war to rescue German science.
And it's also debated as to whether he actually wholeheartedly tried to develop an atomic weapon for the Germans. There was that famous meeting with Bohr in 1941 in Copenhagen, the subject of Michael Frayn's play Copenhagen, but nobody seems to know what really happened.
I looked at that very carefully, including there's some recently released letters from the Niels Bohr archive, letters which Niels Bohr wrote after the war to Werner Heisenberg, but which he somehow never got round to sending. And basically what these letters were saying were, you know, Werner, You were once my great friend. Why did you come to Copenhagen in 1941? Why did you come to occupy Denmark? On whose authority was it? So Bohr never knew why Heisenberg came, but he was very suspicious. I think Bohr thought that Heisenberg was there on a fishing expedition from Nazi Germany to find out maybe what was happening with the Allied program. Having looked at it carefully, I think, you know, in Werner Heisenberg's own mind, there was a degree of ambiguity. I think he wanted to satisfy himself that the Allies weren't pushing on fast with a bomb. He was a German patriot. He did not want a bomb dropped on Nazi Germany. Whether he was actually also passing messages about what the German scientists were up to, I'm not so sure. And I've never been convinced by the arguments that the German scientists deliberately sabotaged their own program because they didn't want Hitler to have the bomb.
When did the Nazis realize that Jewish physics might help them win the war?
I think that the German scientists, well, after the diaspora of the Jewish scientists, the ones who remained behind knew that they'd really lost much of the intellectual heart of the work. It was difficult for them for a while to regroup, having lost some of their very best minds. I think, you know, amongst the German hierarchy, many of them found nuclear physics too tough to comprehend. It's very hard to try and explain it to them. There was a lot of skepticism about whether this was really a sensible weapon to pursue. There was much more enthusiasm for the projects of people like Wernher von Braun and his rockets. That was much easier for them to comprehend. So you find, if you like, during the war, the pendulum switching backwards and forwards in Germany as to whether people like Goebbels and Speer, the armaments minister, were prepared to listen to the scientists and to give them the resources. And there was never really a wholehearted commitment or understanding, I think, of nuclear weapons.
And we can be grateful for that.
Absolutely.
You only briefly discussed Mo Berg, but I want to ask you a bit about him. He was a baseball player, a catcher for the Washington Senators and Boston Red Sox. How did he get involved in this story?
Yeah, again, I mean, this shows that this was not just a story about science. This was a story about real sort of cut and throat thing, you know, extraordinary dramas. What happened was that the Allied scientists, particularly the refugee scientists who'd gone over to America in the Manhattan Project, they were very worried about, well, what was Werner Heisenberg, this brilliant man, this Nobel Prize winner, what was he up to in Nazi Germany? News came that Heisenberg would be addressing a scientific group in neutral Switzerland. Mo Berg, by now a secret agent, was dispatched to Switzerland with a very strange mission. He was told a bit about what was happening with the bomb project, everything that he needed to know to make a judgment. And this judgment was that he had to listen very carefully to what Heisenberg was saying. If Heisenberg said anything to suggest that the Nazis were seriously onto the bomb, Mo Berg's mission was to kill him. In his pocket, he had a revolver. At the lecture, Heisenberg didn't say anything to convince Berg that the Germans were getting close, but that didn't satisfy Berg. He was absolutely a professional. He accosted Heisenberg. He walked back with him through the ill-lit cobbled streets of this Swiss town, and he introduced himself as a stranger. He quizzed Heisenberg. Heisenberg, of course, never knew that his life depended on what he was saying to Berg. Berg didn't hear anything that convinced him the Germans were close, so Heisenberg lived, but it could have been quite different.
And his German was that good that he could speak on that level?
That's right. I mean, he could not pretend, I think, to actually be a German, but he convinced Heisenberg that he was somebody, you know, European, who spoke, you know, reasonable German. Heisenberg was completely taken in by him. Heisenberg was not suspicious of who was this man, you know, raincoat who sidled up to him and asked him all those questions.
A major league baseball player with a very bad batting average, but that's another matter.
I didn't know.
If the war made for strange bedfellows, Major League Baseball and the U.S. military, Roosevelt and Stalin, not least among them, so did the quest for the chain reaction that would permit the nuclear weapons we know and fear today also involve scientists who don't normally associate with the military? We have J. Robert Oppenheimer and Colonel Leslie Groves. Oppenheimer, known for his leftist sympathies, Groves, most certainly a conservative figure. How do they come together?
Yeah, I found this relationship extraordinary. On the one hand, you see Oppenheimer, this extraordinary sensitive, a Renaissance man, if you like. Groves, the blunt army engineer, you know, the man who'd helped build the Pentagon. You know, what was it like when you brought those two together? But it was Groves who absolutely insisted, you know, when he was put in charge of the Manhattan Project, that Oppenheimer was the man that he needed to run the scientific side. And although he was very concerned about security issues and normally, you know, had no truck with anybody who was a communist or a communist sympathizer, in the case of Oppenheimer, he was prepared to overlook Oppenheimer's left-wing leanings. He absolutely insisted, in the teeth of fierce opposition, that Oppenheimer was the man. He was dead right. And actually, between the two of them, that was the chemistry was right. That's really what made the Manhattan Project work.
Although we could also say that Oppenheimer was used until he did what he had to do, and then he had all of his problems.
Exactly.
Suddenly it was discovered that he hadn't been a communist, but he had relatives who were?
Yes, a wife and a girlfriend with communist associations. And he was certainly, you know, he was a liberal left-wing thinker. Absolutely no doubt about that. But he was absolutely focused on his task at Los Alamos. There was no evidence that he'd, you know, in any sense ever betrayed his country. And Groves later, you know, at the anti-communist hearings that Oppenheimer got involved in after the war, Groves testified to that effect.
We know the people who passed on secrets. Klaus Fuchs, and then there's another man, I can't remember his name, who lives in Britain, I think, to this day.
Oh, there were people who were involved, yes, there was a British project in Canada as well, running at the same time as the Manhattan Project. But, I mean, Klaus Fuchs was really the chief atom spy. How did he get to the Manhattan Project? How did he get past Leslie Groves? Well, Fuchs, you know, refugee from Germany, the son of a Lutheran pastor, a communist by conviction, had come to England. His Soviet handler told him, lie low, complete your education. Very talented scientist. He came with the British team to Los Alamos. Groves was not enthusiastic about the arrival in 43 of this British contingent, said, I want to, you know, give security clearance myself to all your people. The British said, no, no, trust us. All our people will have been cleared. And, of course, you know, Fuchs slipped through the net. That's why the progress with the atom bomb was no surprise to Stalin. And because of what Fuchs passed them, that's why they were able to conduct their own test as early as 1949.
Two very different bombs were developed. Was one better than the other? One was dropped on Hiroshima, the other was dropped on Nagasaki.
That's right. I mean, this was to do with Leslie Groves, really. He was not a man who left anything to chance. I think this is why he was so successful as the overall leader of the Manhattan Project. He quizzed the scientists early in the project and said, look, what are the two ways of making a bomb? And they said, well, we think we can do it with uranium. We think maybe we can do it with plutonium. But we're not sure which is going to work out best. He said, well, we're going to do both, which is basically what happened. And so, as you say, when you get to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one bomb is a uranium bomb, one bomb is a plutonium bomb.
And eventually we mostly made bombs out of plutonium, didn't we? Why was that considered better?
Plutonium was considered better because it was even easier to fission than this very rare isotope of of hydrogen that you had to manufacture in vast plants. The actual process of making, of manufacturing plutonium was perceived to be easier, although it has to be said that at a very late stage of the project, in 1944, it suddenly looked as if this huge investment at Hanford, in Washington State, where the big plutonium plants were, it all looked as if this huge investment had been for nothing, because the plutonium they were manufacturing was starting to display characteristics that they hadn't anticipated. But they did, in fact, manage to solve those problems, but it was still a little bit uncertain, which is why that the famous Trinity test that happened middle of July 1945 at Alamogordo, that was of the plutonium device, because they were less certain that's what was actually going to work.
Bombs have been made since. Are they pretty much the same thing that we had in 1945?
Much of the technology is very similar, but of course it's very difficult, you know, for classified reasons to get access to that. But yes, I mean, the principles that were established at this time were the principles that have been developed and used ever since.
And those principles are understood by scientists, in fact, in some cases just college students all over the world. Right now, why is it so difficult to develop a bomb?
It depends what sort of bomb you're thinking of. I mean, what size of bomb? I think the thing, you know, many of the scientists in the story that I tell were prescient enough to foresee the arms race, you know, race beyond the end of the Second World War, an arms race between superpowers with the power to build big nuclear devices. What they didn't foresee are the things which frighten us so much today, and which are relatively easier to achieve if you can get your hands on a little bit of nuclear material, are things like dirty bombs, suitcase bombs. But, you know, there was some fear during the war that maybe the Germans would mix radioactive material with bombs. There was, you know, one of the British scientists was going out during the London Blitz for the Geiger counter, seeing whether there was radioactivity coming out of the bomb craters. But the difficulty of actually achieving a device depends on the scale and the amount of nuclear material that you're going to need to achieve your reaction, to achieve your explosion, and also the state of knowledge that you have, the facilities you have to handle what is, after all, dangerous, toxic material.
After the war, did the scientific community ever recover that sense of genuine camaraderie and internationalism, the thing that they'd had at the beginning of the century?
Some of them tried very hard to recreate that, particularly people like Niels Bohr. I mean, even in 1944, Niels Bohr foresaw what was going to happen. He was looking beyond the end of the war. He actually went on a mission to President Roosevelt and said, look, we've got to internationalize this knowledge. It's got to, the great powers have got to take a responsible attitude towards this. He lobbied Roosevelt. He went to see Winston Churchill over in England. And Churchill actually, while not being at all sympathetic to Bohr, put his finger on this whole dilemma. He said, you know, I didn't like this man Bohr. I didn't understand what he was talking about. Was he talking about politics or was he talking about science? But of course, for someone like Bohr and for many of the other scientists, the two things were inextricable. The scientists had helped develop something, therefore they had some moral responsibility for what use was going to be made of it.
In recent years, there has been a clamping down on exchange of information, especially in the United States, a country that in the past really encouraged that sort of thing.
That's right. And this is where you get into one of these ambiguous situations because, you know, as part of the post-war regime, you know, some of what people like Niels Bohr wanted to happen happened. You had things like the International Atomic Agency being set up under the United Nations, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, you know, currently being discussed in a conference in New York. And the purpose of that was really to say to the countries which had nuclear bombs, they had a responsibility for not allowing their material to be diverted and for encouraging other countries not to go down that path. But equally, they had a responsibility to reduce their nuclear stockpiles, but also to encourage the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. And that implies a responsibility, if you like, to share information and to assist other countries, at least to use nuclear power for benign purposes.
Although at times that sharing can lead to real problems, as we've seen in Pakistan, where the developer of the Pakistani bomb has shared what he's learned with a lot of different people, some of the more dangerous countries of the world.
That's right. I mean, that's why it's important with these exchanges that I think you strengthen the international bodies that oversee them as much as possible. You have as much international consensus behind them so that, you know, if the International Atomic Energy Agency sends out inspectors to check what's going on in various nuclear plants, they can, with real authority, see and understand what's happening. They can reassure the international community that material is not being diverted from civil nuclear power programs to military ones. you know, those agencies have got to function effectively, and they need full international support behind them.
When I introduced you, I talked about the picture on the cover of your book. It's a Hugo van de Goes painting of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and Eve is plucking the apple from the tree, and you have an Adam superimposed over the apple, at least in the American edition. My point was that was supposedly the end of innocence in the first case, and now we have unleashed another end of innocence. Can the world ever go back? I mean, from the moment we dropped that first bomb to today, we have lived under the threat of nuclear annihilation, haven't we?
Absolutely. And that's really why I wanted, you know, to tell the story before the fallout. I'm the generation that grew up after the Second World War with this sword of Damocles that we clever human beings had manufactured for ourselves. And we can never be entirely sure what's going to happen with this kind of technology, how it might be deployed. As you say, you know, once we think of something, we can't, unfortunately, turn the clock back. We cannot get rid of it. We're here today with it. We've got to live with it.
Just one more thing. We recently had the mayor of Hiroshima here as a guest. And although he talked about all the people whose lives had been destroyed by the bomb, he said that there's no lasting effect in terms of radiation in his city. How is that possible? I thought that nuclear that radiation had a very long half-life.
Yes, I was surprised by this, you know, because I spent quite a lot of time studying what had happened in Hiroshima, and I spent quite a lot of time in the city. And it was to do with the way that the bomb exploded and how the radioactivity dispersed. But I mean, I was quite nervous about going to Hiroshima for my research. You know, we all have this mental image of a blasted landscape. And I found a city, a vibrant city, much bigger population than at the time of the bombing, full of vitality, little bitterness about the past, obviously a deep sorrow about what happened. But I talked to survivors then. They said what I thought was a very telling human thing. People who'd lived through the bombing and survived, they said, we don't want to be thought of as atom bomb victims or statistics. We don't want to be thought of as hibakusha, which is what they call the victims. We just want to be thought of as human beings in our own right. And it was for them as well that I wanted to tell this story.
Diana Preston's book is Before the Fallout, From Marie Curie to Hiroshima, published by Walker & Company. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.